ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land, green dot. Welcome to Oshkosh, guys.
Hello and welcome to the Green Dot, EAA's podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. I'm Hal Bryan. I'm one of your hosts. I'm EAA's managing editor for print and digital content and publications. And down there at the end of a long and very well-appointed table, it is...
I'm Chris Henry, the museum manager here in Oshkosh.
And Chris, thanks to the magic and wonder of the internet, we have a guest joining us today to talk about something we're really excited about.
Absolutely. And I think a lot of people that are probably listening to this are excited about as well. Today we have Ty Ramey with us. Ty, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Now, there's a lot of different reasons to be excited to talk to Ty. You have a lot of different things going on in vintage aviation and in warbirds. And we'll talk a little bit about, I guess, a lot of that. But really, the big reason, the big thing we want to talk about is Masters of the Air, which is on Apple TV right now and follows the exploits of the 100th Bomb Group, a B-17 unit in World War II. So far, we don't want to give anything away on anybody, but it's amazing. I mean, it is very well done. And we definitely want to talk to you about that a little bit. But first, sort of a lead-in question. We ask everybody this because we always love the answer. You know, how did you first really get involved in aviation? What was your first sort of spark to want to do this?
Yeah, I got to blame my parents for that. My mom was an Army nurse in World War II in the Pacific, and my dad was a B-29 navigator in the Pacific. And so... he grew up with him building model airplanes and learning, you know, just the way a lot of us do, build models and fall in love with that kind of stuff. And that's how I also got into World War II as well, just World War II aviation. And, it's, you know, as a kid going to a flea market, San Jose flea market, and picked up an old Attitude autopilot gyro for a P-47 and took that home to play with it. My dad got me a Norden bomb sight all disassembled in a box and put that back together. And just, you know, always had a heavy interest in World War II. I was having trouble in school. So my dad, as an incentive program, said that he'd give me flying lessons if I could maintain a B grade point average. So that was pretty much the best deal I ever made. And that worked out real well. My dad started flying as he and I both started taking lessons at the same time, and it was a lot of fun. Stanford Flying Club, 172s, and eventually got my license and started doing some commercial work, flight instructing, and kind of I was going to school at San Jose State in the aviation program, and they had a twin beach out back. And like Christmas that year, my dad gave me a gun turret, a new old stock World War II gun turret, new in the crate, had this cover over the top, said turret training type A8 for model AT-11 aircraft. And I said, oh, this is great, Dad, but what the heck is an AT-11? My buddy of mine and I took one of those, out of Saipan, and we buzzed the Japanese on the island of Rota and made the controllers jump out of the control tower. And then he pulled up a picture of what an AT-11 was and say, oh my gosh, this is great, Dad. Now I got to find an airplane to go with my gun turret.
Yes.
And went back to school at San Jose State, and they had two Beech-18s in the back for instructional airframes. And I was sitting in one of them, you know, spitting on the windshield, hanger flying, thinking I'm going to own one of these someday. And the other twin Beech sitting in front of it, I saw in the fuselage, it had a circle of rivets, like where the turret went. And yet it didn't have a glass nose on it. So I went over and looked and pulled up the floorboards, and there's the mounting plate for the turret. And holy cow, this was an AT-11 at one time. Went right in, talked to the department chairman to see if this, you know, freshman would, you know, can talk him out of one of his airplanes in his backyard. And he says, well, actually, we just decided to sell those aircraft without the engines. But, you know, as a freshman, I don't think you really know what you're getting into. I said, I'm certain I have no idea what I'm getting into, but I got to have this airplane. He says, okay, well, it's $250 without the engines. Like, oh my gosh. So I had to borrow $250 from my mom, but that was my first airplane. And that, frankly, that started that Christmas gift of that gun turret and that AT-11 started the whole Twin Beach thing. So I had a choice to go off to do the airline thing with a lot of my other friends, but decided to take the vow of poverty and did the Twin Beach thing and been pretty, you know, it's been a great ride ever since. So it's been a lot of fun. So how's that for a long-winded answer to your question?
That's awesome.
It's a great start. And I understand, Ty, in addition to Twin Beaches and things, there's a Harpoon in your world.
Yeah, sure is. Funny how things kind of come to us, but back in San Jose State, there was a gal that was going there that she was part of the family that had that. And she said, hey, you got to go check out this airplane and it'd be great for you. And years later, we did. We heard through another guy that this airplane was going to get cut up for scrap. And so we went up and looked at it. And it was the guy had bought, I think, 3 or 4 PB2s and brought them in. They were all tanker configuration and flew this one to his personal ranch, Hidden Valley Lake, California. And it just sat there from, I think it was 78 is when it came in, and no, not 81. But anyway, so it parked there and just basically nobody touched it since. And so the guy had passed away, the land had been sold, and Everett Serafuel owned the airplane because they'd bought engines and the airplane came with it, and they didn't want it. So they ended up donating it to us. Before we decided to take on that big project, we went up and looked at it. We flew up there in the Twin Beach on this old dirt strip and started looking at it close. And people previously had said, oh, it's all corroded. The control cables are all rotten, all rusted away. They said it's just really bad. So I saw a different airplane. You know, that what they said were rusted control cables was actually the Peralcatone from the factory that they dipped the cables in. So it was a preservative. And I couldn't find any corrosion on the airplane. The ground squirrels were living in it, using it as a high-rise apartment building. So they were, you know, the ground squirrel excrement was everywhere. But thankfully, it was 1,000 feet up in dry California environment, and it didn't cause any corrosion, amazingly enough. We cleaned all that stuff up, and the airplane turned out to be pretty decent. So we went back home, packed up all the tools and parts and stuff, and flew up there in the beach and started working on it. The first day, we got the left engine running, had to change the boost pump. Next day, we got the right engine running, and the plane did really well. We've done a lot of this kind of thing where we resurrect old dead airplanes, and sometimes they're sleeping pretty hard, and it takes a lot to wake them up. Other planes, not so much. This airplane, she wanted to get out of there bad. I think she knew that the axe was coming, and she didn't fight us at all. So we got even taxi around on the old dead tires, and ended up able to do power runs, we flew up there. I think it was 8 times in the beach, and then ended up driving the trailer up to bring the jacks to jack the thing up, and did gear swing, and ended up flying her home. And on the takeoff roll, all the props kicked up the weeds and dirt and packed the front of the oil coolers closed, so all the oil temps were going up right at the red line. So I thought both engines were quitting. But it turns out once we got leveled off and powered back, they came back. And she, like I said, she could have landed herself. You know, I don't think I was necessary in the cockpit because she wanted to get out of there so bad. So ever since then, we've been fixing her up and turning her back into a Warbird. Lately, we've been hitting air shows. We've got a World War II vet, Pat Pattison, 102 years old, and he's been flying right seat in the airplane to all the shows we've been going to. We just did Reno last year, and then Mather after that, and man, he greased the thing on. He flew 24 missions, 3 tours in out of the Aleutians in PB1s and PB2s. And still is sharp and doing a great job. So that's the neatest thing in the world, to see Pat and World War II vets still able to fly these things.
That's incredible. And I'm sure, you know, it means the world to him, because that story doesn't always get out there of what those crews did and things like the PBYs or the Harpoons. And, it's a story worth telling, because those missions were certainly hazardous and dangerous as well.
Sure were. And yeah, nobody really knows about that stuff. And that's one of the nice things, is to get this aircraft to the shows and the little signboards. And Pat, frankly, we can't get the guy to sit down. He'll stand there and talk to people and tell stories. It's the neatest thing. Spreading the word about this Forgotten War, I think one of the books called it. They flew against the Japanese at the northern end of Japan and the Kuril Islands and 24 missions. And God, he's got some great stories, and he's so sharp. It's just, yeah, it's the best. We almost put a full crew together for the Harpoon, but sadly we lost a bunch of the guys. We've had, I think, 6 or 7 of them fly in the aircraft over the years since we got it going. Frankly, Pat's one of the only ones left.
Wow. Wow. As we're talking about it too, I'm also getting a flashback to the Jaws movie where they tell the story of the one guy's talking about dropping the bomb, and he actually mentions a harpoon in it, which was always surprising to me as a kid. I'm like, wow, this movie actually touched on what a harpoon was. That was one of the ones that found the USS Indianapolis survivors.
Right. You know, and
yeah, it sure was.
Sort of a moment in pop culture.
It was actually PV-1, but pretty darn close. And
yeah,
we even met the son of the guy, Gwyn, I'm sorry, who was flying it. And then we ended up using our harpoon for a movie for USS Indianapolis Men of Courage.
Oh.
Good flying scenes, I guess I'll say that. Yeah, good flying scenes.
Well, thank you for the good flying scenes part.
Yes.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun doing the flying for that. And we've done a few little movies or TV show things here and there, but of course nothing compares to Masters of the Air. But it was a lot of fun. We opened the bomb bay doors for the first time in flight and all sorts of other stuff. But they still promise us some of the extra footage, but I haven't quite seen that yet.
All right. So speaking of Masters of the Air, we definitely have to talk about it. How did you sort of first become involved in it? What was your first inkling and what did you do? Like, what was your role?
You know, years ago when word got out that Hanks and Spielberg were going to make this, I just like, oh my gosh, I got to get involved. And I would send emails off to every, you know, email address or person I could think of to say, you know, pick me. But I'm sure there was 1,000 other folks doing the same thing. So that, you know, nothing ever came of that. But frankly, it was bomber camp. So we do this bomber camp event where we used to fly in the Collings airplanes in their B-17 and B-24, where we teach people. It's kind of like a fundraiser for our museum, but we teach people how to use all the old equipment, bomb sites, gun sites, radio equipment, navigation stuff, everything, all the gunnery gear, turrets. And we do that with the Collings we're doing it now with Erickson's aircraft, their B-17. But I think it was the bomber camp event was what caught their eye. Michael Fawley and Steven Rosenbaum suggested me, I guess, to the staff. And Michael Fawley sent me an email if I was interested. And I said, yeah, you bet. And then I got a conference call with a bunch of them. I said, I'd be happy to help. And initially they were talking about wanting to send the actors to us, to bomber camp, to do it here. But, you know, we only get the aircraft once a year, so that wasn't feasible. And then so they ended up asking me to come out there. So the original plan was to come out for 2 weeks and teach the actors how to look like they can fly a B-17 teach the bombardiers and the navigators and radio operators and gunners as well. So they signed me up for a 2-week gig and went out to England to the studios just northwest of London and started teaching the actors. Dave Littleton's a guy who's he's a World War II aviation nut for a long time over there, and he built a cockpit in his garage over 20 plus years. And it's all real parts or stuff he made, and he just did a wonderful job. So he had that nose section there, was sitting on the ground. So we used that for a lot of the training. So I started training these guys, and you know, I just assumed that a lot of these kids would have, you know, experience at flying simulators or some kind of experience with flying, but not a single one of them did. So I set them down in a chair and kind of made them look like they're holding a control yoke, and I taught them how the ailerons and the elevator and the rudders work and how to coordinate your hands and your feet. And even though it probably won't see a lot of rudder stuff, but, you know, they need to make look like they're using their feet because, you know, B-17 would be a heavy rudder airplane like most of these big twins or big multi-engine tail draggers are. So I'm teaching them all that. And then we moved into the cockpit and taught them how to hold the throttles and where to look for power changes, you know, on the panel. And, you know, they started doing the crew stuff where the, you know, co-pilot's backing up throttles or he's working the prop controls or, you know, all that kind of stuff in the sequence in starting. That was a, you know, pretty full 2 weeks. We got a lot done and I'm like getting ready to go home. I had a return ticket and I checked in with production about heading out. And they said, oh, didn't they tell you? I said, you're going to stay. I said, I'm going to stay for what? I said, you're going to stay for all the filming. I said, no, nobody mentioned it to me or asked me. they said, oh, yeah. So I, thankfully, my daughter, Sydney, and and Ricky, you know, good folks back home to take care of stuff while I was gone at the shop. And because they knew how important this was to me and in general. And so, I stayed. It was supposed to be 6 months of filming, but we had COVID hits and delays and all sorts of stuff. And it was 9 months. So we got home just before Christmas.
Wow.
But it was, yeah, it was incredible. It really was. You know, it was a 9-to-5, 5 day a week job. And then on the weekends, I was off to go play like at Thorpe Abbott's where the 100th Bomb Group was. There's a museum there. Man. And remnants of the old airfield are all around. I got this old World War II map and put it over Google Earth and was able to find all sorts of neat things out there. And one of the actors has a metal detector. He's really good at it. So we'd go off and search around the old hard stands and start finding amazing things. I mean, this guy was great. He'd, by the sound on his metal detector, he said, "Oh, this is a 50 caliber round." And sure enough, 6 inches down, here comes a fully live 1942 or 43 dated, you know, armor piercing incendiary round that, you know, darn well flew over Fortress Europe. And, you know, when they were cleaning out the plane, they tossed this off the hard stand and there it was. And one bullet is illegal there. So we'd pull the projectile off and then pour the powder out and light it off. And boy, that stuff burned just as fresh as the day it was made. Oh, so it was really cool. Amazing. So we found all sorts of B-17 parts and all, you know, neat things, you know, around there. It was great. So it was so fun to go off to museums or military vehicles. A wonderful bunch of living history guys there that do Army Air Force stuff and go playing with those guys. And on the weekends, it was just kind of a dream come true, really. It was an amazing job.
That's just incredible to think about, what you think is a 2 week gig turning into 9 months. That's just, you could have a kid in that time. Yeah. That's just unbelievable. Ty, I was curious when you were starting to do this training stuff, and I think from what you said, I know the answer to it, but it's interesting to me. You're talking about, you know, this is how you hold the throttles and this is where you look during power changes and stuff like that. Were you working from a script at all at that point and saying like, okay, when you say this line, you're going to look here, or were you truly giving them like enough information so that when they were interpreting the script and actually shooting that they actually had enough knowledge to basically do all those things and go through those motions?
Yeah. So we started out just the generic stuff, teaching them all the basics. And if you do a power change, look here, or this is what you do, this is the sequence. And we had checklists too. So we ran through the wartime checklist and wow, that changed. So we had to use ones that were period correct for, June of 43 when the 100th made it out there. So, you know, we did a lot of generic stuff. And then the scripts, I started getting the scripts and I, you know, was able to make comments about the scripts, certain things that, you know, weren't, that needed some help authenticity wise or detail wise. And Carrie, the director of the first episodes, was really open. We worked a lot together on that kind of stuff, fixing things. And then we'd start preparing for a scene. So I would train the actors for this specific scene. And whether, you know, they're pilots or bombardiers. And then the director would come out and we'd show him, you know, what we were training and presenting. And then he would have some input, want to do this or this. And then we'd change things around. But the actors had a basic knowledge. And a lot of them were, I mean, these kids are really sharp. Austin and Callum were the two head guys. But all the other guys were really sharp as well. And they pick up on this stuff and really want to learn. And so things would change, you know, Carrie would change things kind of on the fly sometimes. And so we'd have to get on the microphone and say, okay, we're going to do this now. And with their those kids being so sharp, it was pretty straightforward. And, I had a microphone and could talk to them and we go through things and then fix a scene. And some scenes, you know, we shot, of course, didn't make the final cut, but a lot of them did. I need to preface this because I'm not typed in a B-17, never said that I was, but with Collings and with Mac, I've flown, a bunch into B-17, and I was typed in the B-24. So for Collings, I was on tour with the B-24 and the B-25. So a lot of the procedures are pretty much identical from one plane to the next, but what was really fun was, learning about what they were doing in June of 43. And I learned a lot. One of the things I didn't realize is they were doing three-point takeoffs, fully loaded B-17, taking off three-point attitude, just right at stall, right? And they did have some accidents. And as a result, they changed that process later on. Instead of getting off as soon as you can out of a 3-point, then they went to, you know, the tail comes up, you get a little more speed and a little more of a safety margin. And that happened a little bit later in the war. So we taught the 3-point takeoffs to begin with and then transitioned to tail coming up off the runway later on. And then the other procedures too. And it gave them choices, like on that throttle thing. You know, here's normally you do hands up on the throttles. Here's how they work for the different engines. And but it's your choice. You want to put, you know, palm down, that's fine, palm up. And then we went through emergency procedures because we had a lot of engine shutdown stuff. Some of it's made it through the final cut, but a lot of it was not. But yeah, we did a lot of specific scenes and training with the specific scenes. And it was interesting because it varied from director to director too. There's supposed to be 10 episodes to start. Each director had two episodes. Carrie bargained for doing the first 4 episodes, a lot of the heavy flying stuff. And then the other directors had 2 each. I think the one director had 1 because they ended up cutting 1 episode out. So it was interesting to see the differences from one director to the next. And, you know, I'm an airplane guy. we've done a little bit of movie stuff and TV stuff, but nothing compared to this. And so it was really interesting to see how all this stuff works behind the scenes, and it's amazing. One guy said, you know, once you've seen this, you know, once you see how it's put together, you'll never watch a movie again the same way. And it's true. You know, I'm watching some shows going, I could just picture the sound guy and his mixing board and the guy with the boom mic and all the cameramen and all the people. It's just, it was a, you know, an eye opener in many, many different ways.
Well, you mentioned the guys who basically play Clevin and Egan, I remember seeing what's really fun. This is the first time that I've been following a production this close, where you get to see, you know, if you're following their like Instagrams or their social media, you know, they were posting some stuff behind the scenes, and you were so excited every time one of those little pictures came out where they were just taking a break, but you know, in the background is this full scale B-17 mock-up or something. You're just like, oh my god! But I remember watching. It may have been something you posted where you guys were even having like sort of races to see who can get in through the nose hatch of the 17 the quickest.
Yeah, that was that happened pretty early on. So yeah, we got to teach them how to get in a B-17, and we had a fuselage there in the studio, but it's, you know, sitting horizontal and it's, you know, a foot and a half off the floor, and so it's hard to teach, you know, a real B-17 sitting on its tail where you have to reach over your head and almost jump up to grab the, you know, the bar, basically the reinforcement on the upper part of the hatch. So teaching these guys how you got it, you know, grab on, swing your feet in, and they were swinging their feet towards the front. I said, got to remember, you know, the plane's going to be, you know, sitting in a tail low attitude, so you need to swing your feet to the back. But yeah, they turned into a competition. These guys were just racing each other to who could do it better. And Austin, yeah, kicked butt. I think he did it in a little over 6 seconds, and nobody else came even close to that. I got another video. I should post that sometime. Taken from the front, so you could see him coming in, but the sound is the best because you hear the bang, boom, shoot, and, you know, cussing and swearing and head bashing and boots. Oh, it's just, it cracks me up. But there's a couple good scenes. One that just came out recently with Rosie standing there just kind of, you know, pausing with that whole, you know, how do you get back into this airplane kind of thing going on. And grabs up and flings himself in there just like a pro. Yeah, it's pretty neat to see. Yeah,
that was awesome.
Really looked good.
Can you tell us a little bit about what was it like to work? Did you get to work with any of the full-scale mock-ups?
Yeah, we sure did. So initially, I went out to the field. It's an old RAF field called Abingdon, and that's where the 2 mock-ups were there. And one of them has motors on the wheels so that it can drive around. They actually had Collings wheels and tires on them. They're like flat-spotted, you know, unairworthy tires. So there were that was only some of the only real B-17 parts. So, yeah, I was working with those guys out there in the field, even help with the folks, you know, where vehicles would be set up. You know, we have the, like the emergency vehicles, got a wrecker truck and a Klee track and the ambulances and how they would be set up. And then how that stuff would mesh. So worked out in the field a lot for a long time. And then when they got the studio set up, then I went inside the studio and did most of my film work there. Dave went out to the field. He had taken time off his job and had 6 months off for that job and had to go back to work. So he missed the last 3 months, but he was out in the field mostly. And then he had to go. But so I did kind of both. I'd go bouncing back and forth between the studio and out in the field. But yeah, those mock-ups were really darn impressive. All steel structure, steel tube inside, and aluminum on the outside. It's put together with pop rivets, but you got to be pretty close to see that they're pop rivets. And the shape and most of the details were really spot on. They did a great job. And yeah, you'd have to get pretty close to tell that it really wasn't a B-17.
And Ty, did you say there were two full-scale mock-ups built?
Yeah, there sure were two full-size airplanes, you know, complete one-to-one scale. And they had, like, cockpits in them, but the rest of the structure was, you know, like they weren't set up for the interior shots mostly. The nose is pretty good, and the cockpit was pretty good on one of them especially, and on the others not so much. So gotcha. There were only two full-size planes there. So when you watch the show and you see a whole bunch of B-17s taxiing out,
that's
a lot of CG stuff and mixing things together. Which is pretty darn impressive. You know, some people complaining they should have used real B-17s, but there's just no way you could ever do anything like this with, you know.
Yeah, there's just not enough of them.
Real planes are just aren't around, and the logistics is just insane to think about. So they did a pretty good job. And one of the sound guys came to me once, was asking about sounds, and I said, you know, you've got a whole lot of B-17 sounds that you're going to need to record. You know, the stuff we've been practicing in the cockpit where it's you know, hit boost pump switches and hearing the boost pumps go, or, you know, the engine starts. So you have inertia starters. And it was funny because they had a radial engine wind machine out there. And I was talking to Steven Rosenbaum about that. I said, you know, the sounds that this thing makes when it starts and coughs and all that stuff would be very helpful to you. The howl of the brakes, you know, on a B-17, those things make a wailing sound that if you have a whole bunch of them, you know, these planes taxiing out, that's a big important sound. Yeah, engine starts, the cough, the belching, all that kind of stuff. So I made them a big list of sounds that they're going to need for the show. And they actually went out to Sentimental Journey at CAF group out in Falcon Field and got the recordings from their B-17, which is really nice. But that sound stuff, you know, that's the one thing about this whole production, the details. Just, I mean, it was like Band of Brothers. It's the devil is in the details, and it's what makes it so good and special. And from those sounds to just so thousands and thousands of other details that really, you know, come together to make this special. And sure enough, there's some problems and mistakes and some Hollywood stuff in there. But, you know, I tell people for every one thing you want to complain about, you need to tell me 10 things that are just amazing that you haven't seen before. Because, yeah, there's so much in this show that, you know, just no film done about, you know, 8th Air Force stuff since World War II has come even close to putting these kind of details in.
What I love is stuff like, you know, I don't want to give anything away to our listeners who maybe aren't caught up or haven't seen it yet. You know, the stuff where the crew chief, you know, riding in a wheel well out to the runway. I mean, was amazing. That what's amazing to me is you'll get these details of something like that and somebody will post about it like, wow, that was wild. And then, especially if you're in like a lot of the 100th Bomb Group page and stuff like that, you'll find a lot of times like the granddaughter of the mechanic in question has his diary and scans a page and it talks about that. And I mean, it's insane. I mean, just that kind of stuff where it's like, wow, that really happened. You know, that's too cool.
It really is. And this whole thing, you know, is put together by John Orloff. He wrote the screenplay and did a lot of the research on this, and most all of the stuff that's in this show is true. It really happened. And working with Raph Law on that. So that was at one point where we didn't have the script or information, or I didn't have it myself, and talking to Carrie about filming the scene. And you know, he's got to ride in the gear well, and I'm like, well, you pull that access panel off in the gear well, the only thing you get to are magnetos and a starter and a generator. So, you know, he must have done the magnetos. And because frankly, I didn't have his book. I didn't have access to that information at that point when Carrie and I were talking about the scene. And I suggested, let's, you know, what about, you know, adjusting the magnetos? He said, well, can you just change a magneto? And Carrie even wanted to change a carburetor or something. I said, no, you can't do that. You know, he's taxing out. Come on. So, you know, it's got to be the points. Let's do the points. And And he said, okay, well, show me what that's going to be like. And then I went in, this gal, Jessica, had a Lemon's book, and she gave me a copy, and I was able to read in there. And sure enough, he was adjusting the points. Ah, perfect. So I guessed right on that one. And that's how we ended up working. And that's when I finally got the script. That's exactly what Orloff had written as well. And it's just amazing to think that they had engine trouble. It was actually engine number 3. It's depicted as number 2, but it's engine number 3. And he just needed adjusted points. And hey, taxi out on 3 engines. And that's where some of the Hollywood came in. So he adjusted the points as he went out. And then, you know, as he's in line, they would start this engine up, did a full power check and a mag check, and it was fine how it originally went. And then they continued in line and then took off and went off on the mission. But it's, you know, in the scene, it showed a little bit differently. It's a little bit Hollywood, kind of cut down a bit. But yeah, I mean, Lemons really did that stuff. And a lot of this stuff that's going on, you know, throughout the show, it actually happened. This is real stuff. And sure, there's dramatization going on, but it's just mind-blowing that, you know, what these guys went through. And especially the 2 main characters, you know, they were training together and they went through this whole entire thing together. As you guys watch the show, it's just incredible because most all of it is spot on accurate.
Well, that I think is one of the most important things that something like this, or, you know, the predecessors like Band of Brothers and the Pacific can accomplish, is to just remind everybody. I mean, even those of us who kind of live and breathe this stuff and study it and grew up thinking about it, remind us all that it was real. And even more importantly, try to put us back in that era when it wasn't a foregone conclusion. You know, we talk about World War II now, and it's like, well, it was big and terrible, but the good guys won, and, you know, success happened, and it all turned out. But you have to go back and put yourself in that position and remember when that was the farthest thing from a foregone conclusion, that these guys had no way of knowing that we were going to win, much less if any individually were going to survive.
Yeah, and if you go back even early when we first started, like the Memphis Belle kind of time period, you know, all of this stuff was brand new. This aerial warfare on such a scale had never been done, not even close. And to be able to put these aircraft together, figure out how to fly them in formation, figure out how to get them to the target, how to drop the bombs, the procedures with the bomb sites and the bomb runs and then the gunners and the formations, how it was set up to create maximum protection from the enemy aircraft. It's just incredible. And people do take a lot of that stuff for granted, but, you know, it was a brand new learning curve. And Jimmy Doolittle and all these guys were, you know, top in the Air Corps, and they're all just trying to figure this stuff out too. And they did a hell of a job, but the attrition, the loss rate was unbelievable. And then how's that affect the guys when, you know, so many people were shot down, so many aircraft shot down, and all your buddies are gone. And, you know, that's one of the neat things that they portray, not only the ground crew, but how do these guys, you know, get back in that airplane, and how do they continue this fight when you had to, a lot of them said, you just knew that you were dead. And once you accepted that fact that you're dead, then you could do your job and keep doing it. And that's exactly what they had to do. And it was, you know, they hadn't invented or understood PTSD or a lot of that other stuff, but this is where it was showing up, right at the, you know, they were trying to figure this stuff out. And a lot of guys were called yellow when they cracked up and couldn't continue. And they were put down. And man, it's hard. They learned a lot, and flight surgeons were recognizing this, and that's where the flak farm stuff came from. And you know, it's like, that's one of the things our museum likes to show about World War II, is amazing the advancements that were made through those four short years. Just incredible. But yeah, it's nice that this show portrays, you know, the ground guys and the people, you know, behind the scenes and the emotional and psychological impact, you know, doing this. It's just, it's profound. It really is.
Absolutely. You know, I just have to ask, and I just wonder, having been there and worked so closely with everything, what's it like to sit back and watch it all done? And is that fun, or is it fun kind of watching the reactions from everybody? Because it certainly seems well received.
It really is fun. We have every Friday night we at our museum, we've got a kind of big screen to project onto it, and people come and watch it. It is fun to see their reactions. It's enjoyable for me. You know, I filmed a lot of the stuff, but a lot of the stuff I had no connection with whatsoever, so it was really neat to see. There was one scene that I was watching with Crosby and his roommate. I don't want to give much away, but I was able to watch that scene on my monitor with the audio and watch these actors play the scene out. I was just like, wow, this is really good. And it's one of my favorite scenes, and it was really neat to be able to watch that, you know, on the screen. And we're fortunate enough to be able to go down and watch the premiere to be able to see it on the big screen too, the first episode. And it is really neat to see, especially when I see some of the stuff that I had a big hand in, work with Carrie on stuff, and it's like, wow, there it is, you know, that made it through the cut. But yeah, it's also all sorts of strange to see people's reactions online and the positive and negative stuff. It seems to be overwhelmingly positive, and it's teaching people what it was like for these folks, and that's the important thing. Like Band of Brothers, you know, that was what, 20 plus years ago, and it still is a testament to what those folks went through, and this show will live on in the future when we're all gone, and that will be a stark reminder of what it was like for the folks of the Greatest Generation of World War II.
It's
been a lot of fun to watch.
Well, it's been, as we've said, it's been very well received and deservedly so. And it's great to know that the people behind it took time to reach out to people like you to help get as many of the details right as they could. So you have our thanks as happy viewers for that. So as we're recording this, Masters of the Air is coming out weekly on Apple TV Plus. If you get a chance and haven't, I'm sure just about everybody listening is aware of it, and you've probably all watched everything so far, but give it a look if you haven't. Ty, where can people go online to learn more about Bomber Camp and your museum?
You just do a Google search for Bomber Camp. Our website is bombercamp.org. And there's just a lot of photos and videos and stuff online from past camps. And you can sign up for camp this year. We're doing something new and different. Our Bomber Camp is just once a year. Like I said, with the Ericsson's B-17, you get to we teach you in the morning session. We teach you radio, navigation, bombardier, and gunnery. Then you get hands-on experience. You get to ride the ball turret and check out on that. In case you want to try it in flight, teach about the bombardier stuff. And you can actually get to go up in a B-17 and drop a dummy bomb with a Norden bomb sight. You can shoot a 50 caliber blanks out of the waist, crawl all around the different crew positions in the airplane with all the equipment. You know, all the vehicles and the gear and the tools are all there. And it's an amazing experience. We're now doing Bomber Camp on demand. It's a non-flying version. Let's say, you know, your grandfather was a pilot and you want to learn what he did. You can come out and spend a day with me one-on-one, show you all the different like clothing and equipment and electric flying suits and oxygen gear and headgear. And then you can sit in a B-17 cockpit we've got and learn that. Or if someone was a gunner or you just want to learn more about it, you can come and I'll teach you all about the gunnery and what all is involved with that. You actually get to touch the guns and turrets and take the ball turret for a spin as well. And yeah, bombardier navigation, ground support crew, anything you can think of. If you have an interest, we have Bomber Camp on demand. It's also available. You can go check it out and sign up at bombercamp.org. So yeah, appreciate you let me do the plug, and it helps our museum, and it's a lot of fun keeping this stuff alive. So you can come out and hear a Norden bomb sight run. We can even teach you how to start up the radial engine on a Twin Beach or on the Harpoon if you want. There's all sorts of things to do, but I like keeping the stuff alive, and that's another good thing about this show is bringing it to life. So,
you know, if you hear a sudden just thud and then dead silence, that's Chris and I dropping our headphones and just getting down there.
Yes. We're looking at rental cars right
yes,
now.
Yes, exactly. Road trip.
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds like so much fun. It's great what you're doing there, Ty. Well, thanks so much again for taking the time to join us and to give us a look behind the scenes at something that's really got our attention right now with Masters of the Air. And thanks, as always, to everybody out there for listening. Thank you for taking the time to send us feedback, which you can always do at feedback@eaa.org. You can make comments. Each episode has a landing page off of our blog at inspire.eaa.org. But we really also really, really appreciate reviews left either at Apple Podcasts or wherever you consume your podcast. Those reviews and that wonderful, nice, high rating that we have make us one of the most popular aviation podcasts out there. We're quite proud of that. And your comments, your insights, and your reviews are the reason that we're able to continue doing this. So with that, our thanks again to all of you for listening, and we'll catch up to you next time when you're cleared to land on the green dot.